Hello, and welcome to the Panzer Podcast. My name is John Burgess, and I will be your host today as we deep dive into all things tanks. Today, my friendly listeners, we will finally, and I do mean finally, we will enter the inescapable, undisputable M4 Sherman lineage. From here on out, we are on the cusp of greatness. We will watch, or more like listen, to the story unfold before our very earballs, which will be the formation of our beloved Sherman. Granted, it may still take a few more episodes, but I wanted to assure everyone that this was indeed the Sherman series. Sure, it's taken us a few, or five, or probably going to be more episodes, but we're finally here. The timeline will start to stretch out a little bit more, and our focus will tighten up as we creep ever closer towards our ultimate goal. As much as I love a good preamble as much as the next person, let's get on with it. Quote, Item 12876 of the Ordnance Committee Minutes, OCM, dated 21 May 1936, recommended the development of the medium tank T-5. The approval of this recommendation initiated the program which eventually led to the most widely produced tank in United States history, the M4 General Sherman. End quote. Honeycutt makes it plain, in only the way he could. We have finally arrived at the promised land, Sherman Country. Well, maybe like on the outskirts of Sherman Country, but we're in the same area code, just about anyway. I do want to turn the clock back just a little bit, and recalling episode 202, the second episode of the second season, wherein we discussed the medium tank T2 prototype. Well, I mentioned how much this medium tank reminded me of the Stuart light tank, which, I apologize, I believe I referenced the M2 as a Stuart. The Stuart is actually of the M3 variety. However, the T2 medium tank prototype did in fact become the M2 light tank, which is actually the precursor to the M3 Stuart light tank. So I was only half wrong with my earlier descriptor. Please forgive me. My point in bringing up the T2 or the M2 light tank is twofold. One, the tech tree gets a little intertwined here, and secondly, the medium tank T5 is essentially the M2 light tank plussed up. The T5, at this point, was done cultivating mass and was finally ready to harvest. The proposition set forth by the infantry board, who had finally decided to raise their hand and put forth some requirements of their own for this new medium tank. Once more, 15 tons was going to be the limit for the medium tank. And yes, before you email me, the M2 light tank also weighed 15 tons. So how much beefier was the T5 compared to the M2, you're asking? Just hold on. I'll get there. This weight limit wasn't due to the fact that the Army had no idea how much a medium tank should weigh. No. This was actually due to the limit of the U.S. primary road system, which included bridges. These bridges being capable of only safely carrying 15 tons. I wish the story were more interesting than that, but that's it. The U.S. road bridges were not capable, for the most part, of carrying more than 15 tons, and the Army assumed that these infantry-borne tanks would at some point in time need to be able to operate across the continental United States and use the already in place road network. Before the T5 was ever approved as item 12876 of the OCM in May of 1936, a certain Captain G.H. Rary had been tinkering away with some of Christie's own designs. I guess we weren't done with him after all. In his daydreaming and sketching, Captain Rary had proposed in the spring of 1934 that the medium tank T4 and the medium tank T4E1, that being the barbette version, be combined in an almost Akira-like monstrosity of a turreted tank mated with a barbette tank. The horror. What this abomination took shape as is a somewhat cursed drawing of a Christie convertible medium tank T4 with a fuck ton of machine guns sprouting out of it like a porcupine. The army, however, decided against using the Christie suspension and the Christie chassis, and instead decided to move forward with the turreted barbette vehicle on a brand new suspension system known as the Vertical Volute Spring Suspension, or VVSS. Vertical Volute Spring Suspension, or VVSS for short. I've even read it or seen it as simply VVS. But just know that the Vertical Volute Spring Suspension would be considered the early type of suspension systems for the U.S. armored vehicles during the Second World War. So, what is VVSS? Let's maybe start out with what a volute or volute spring is. Well, we've discussed leaf springs, torsion bar springs, and I'm sure everyone has seen several different types of springs. Serpentine springs are commonly used on mattress box springs. There are extension springs, compression springs. There are many more, and several of which do not concern us when discussing armored suspension systems. However, a volute spring, according to Merriam-Webster, is, quote, a spring formed of a conically spiral coil of plate, rod, or wire that is extended or extensible in the direction of the axis of the coil in which direction its elastic force is exerted, end quote. What this means in more plain terms is the volute spring is a compression type spring. It is shaped like a cone, fatter on one end, and tapers generally to a smaller area on the other end. This can differ somewhat, you know, it can be fat on both sides and get skinny in the middle, but for this application that we're discussing, it's going to be conical. The famous British industrialist Sir John Brown is actually the inventor of the volute spring for railway cars in 1848. We're not going to deep dive into him or the rail car industry of the 1840s. But I point this out because these types of springs used in suspension can withstand extraordinarily heavy applications of force, like a rail car or a tank in this instance. Volute springs could handle heavier loads than any conventional coil or leaf springs could. They could compress much further and were ultimately much stronger than anything else available at the time, at least for American manufacturing. Other nations went in different directions, but the U.S. had decided this was the way to go. The springs that ultimately were used on the VVSS system were of the 9,000-pound strength variety, about 4,000 kilos per unit. The early model VVSS systems were simple. Each bogie consisted of a suspension mounting bracket, two road wheels, a track return roller which sat on top, and of course, a volute spring system contained within the mounting bracket in the center, which was supported by pivoting arms, which allowed the suspension to compress and decompress. The benefits of the VVSS system were diverse and somewhat complex. Several pros and cons existed. At this time in our story, there are essentially four types of suspensions available for armored vehicles, each containing their own set of pros and cons. There was leaf spring, torsion bar, the Christie suspension, and VVSS. For what it's worth, before anyone comes at me, the Japanese tank industry was using what was called the bell crank suspension system, but as far as the usual suspects were concerned, the above four were the norm. Anyway, leaf spring systems are somewhat dated at this point, mostly because, in order to support heavier weight, you need to add more leaf springs, which in turn create more weight, which then requires more suspension. See where I'm going here? There is a negative feedback loop once you hit a certain tonnage with leaf springs. So leaf springs are out for the US at this point. Christie's suspension, as we have already discussed, while it was effective, it can take up a lot of internal space and can be kind of complicated to maintain, at least these early versions of it. Torsion bars, like that of the Panther tank, while also kind of difficult to maintain, present a different problem altogether. That is, of course, width. For torsion bars to be most effective, the vehicle itself needs to be wider, which is fine for countries who are going to war with their land-based neighbors. It is altogether something different when a country needs to factor in things like cargo space. Not to mention, torsion bars require more machining to properly install inside of vehicles and thus reduce their mass production plausibility further. VVSS, on the other hand, is a relatively modular system, as we shall see further along in the Sherman series. As the suspension gets modified and improved, you can add, you can subtract, you can modify, you can specialize. I mean, more than you could do with other suspension types, the VVSS was pretty much the go-to. Another positive aspect is that the entire suspension system is self-contained and exists on the outside of the vehicle. Again, this makes it much easier to maintain, to repair, and replace. It also doesn't consume any of the invaluable crew compartment or fighting space within the tank. I hear it now. Wow, VVSS is perfect in every way. No wonder the Americans stuck with it. Again, pros and cons. The primary shortcoming of using VVSS is that the track width was inherently limited. The maximum track width using VVSS was only 16.5 inches, or 41 centimeters, which really reduces the ground pressure and flotation of the vehicle. Actually, it increases the ground pressure and reduces the flotation. That said, the later versions of this suspension system, the horizontal volute spring suspension, seemingly solves, or at least mitigates, this issue as we go on through the years, which, unfortunately, we'll have to wait until later on down the road as we progress into the later Sherman vehicles. The other, more mechanical issue with the VVSS system is that the springs themselves, being shorter, did not allow as much articulation, which would then reduce the ability to traverse particularly difficult terrain and obstacles. Another future problem is going to be weight, but again, we're not quite there. The T5 was only a 15-ton medium tank prototype, just something to bear in mind as we continue down our path toward the Sherman. We'll have plenty of time to cover the ups and the downs as we go on. But for a primer, I think this is a pretty good starting point. We'll get into the minutiae like offset rollers, skids, overhead rollers, concave, welded, spoked, non-spoked, early production, mid to late production, roller bearings versus ball bearings. Oh my God. It gets quite convoluted. For something that looks so relatively unchanged and simple to the untrained eye, but here at the Panzer Podcast, I am here to give us the tools to tap into our very own trained eye. You know, so when you're at a museum, you can keep tapping your friend's shoulder to let them know, hey, look at that early war VVSS bogey. Please note, the Panzer Podcast is not responsible for any friends lost during museum trips after leering Panzer minutia. Okay, let's head back to the T5 prototype. We're still in what the U.S. Army called Phase 1. So let's have a look at this Captain Rary abomination, shall we? I alluded to the U.S. becoming machine gun obsessed in the last episode. Not just because of the sawed-off 50 caliber main armament, which of course, following the Spanish Civil War, most everybody realized that machine guns were just, they weren't going to cut it moving forward. Regardless, you know, regardless of their penetration capabilities, you needed a cannon. The T5 prototype, phase one, was going to essentially be a mobile machine gun pillbox with a turreted cannon on top, along with an ice cream parlor, a newsstand, and a barbecue pit. Okay, I know I'm being hyperbolic, and that's my right as a podcaster. Check your guidelines if you don't believe me. I only mean to demean the T5's phase one, because like most things, combining too many elements into one thing usually ends up producing a really shitty everything. Go watch the Pentagon Wars to get a better sense of what I mean. And yes, I realize that that movie is a fictionalized interpretation of how the M2 Bradley came into existence. Something we'll cover eventually. But the point is, you cannot, usually, create a thing that does well in all areas without failing at others. Even the Death Star had a thermal exhaust port that exposed its most vulnerable weakness. Just look how well that worked out. But really, wanting a mobile pillbox is one thing. Wanting a mobile quick-firing cannon is another. Combining both elements into one and expecting perfection is, well, it's our T5 medium tank phase one prototype. Quote, a 30 caliber machine gun was placed in each of four rotors mounted in the sponsons at the corners of the fighting compartment. The main armament was carried in a turret on top with full traverse. End quote. Machine gun mounted rotor, sponson. We've used these words before. However, what this means in this particular context is a machine gun mounted in a rotor type turret, or even kind of, it's like a mantlet. I would describe it visually as a cylindrical tube, long side vertical, with the machine gun in the center, allowing it to traverse left and right in a circular motion, much like a rotor would turn on its axis. I will post a photograph or two on Instagram so that you can behold this oddity. As far as the sponson is concerned, that is generally the area above or around the tracks. In the T5 Phase 1's case, we're talking about the pillbox barbette position, which does hang over the treads. The four rotors mounted on each of the corners of these sponsons, very much creating a mobile pillbox-looking vehicle. The front end of the vehicle, the lower glacis, is a tall, flat nose, which directly behind it sat the transmission and final drive. And yes, in case you were wondering, the T5 is a front-wheel driven vehicle. The engine was still positioned in the rear, and running the length of the vehicle was the drive shaft that powered the front-powered sprocket wheels, which propelled the tank forward. This is a departure from Christie and prior Rock Island Armory developments of rear-driven vehicles. This is also how the Sherman starts to take its own shape and obtain one of the detracting factors of the vehicle in every iteration. It was kind of a tall vehicle. This was partly due to the drive shaft, which did again run the length of the vehicle, which required the hull and everything else to sit a little bit higher to allow the shaft enough space. In a car, this isn't really a big deal, because you can leave the undercarriage exposed. However, a tank is relatively armored underneath. At the very least, the undercarriage is not going to be exposed to the elements or enemy sappers. So keep that in mind moving forward. We will circle back to this as we progress through the Sherman. This prototype also had cooling fins attached to the final drive housing, basically like a heat sink, as the transmission and the final drive could run a little bit hot and over time could and would fail. This was a stopgap measure, as they figured out better ways to keep the final drive from overheating. The T5 upper glacis sloped at about 45 degrees in a trapezoidal shape, with smaller triangular sloped panels on the flanks of the front nose of the vehicle, which was due to the driver's seat being positioned into the middle and center front of the vehicle. We're taking another step back for a second by positioning the driver center front like in earlier model prototypes. The driver's compartment really almost looks like a cockpit of sorts, with vision hatches and portholes, which were now behind a plate of bulletproof glass. This is an improvement. We've finally removed the direct line portal to the outside, and often during combat, a very dangerous outside world. At least, well, especially for the driver, but for everyone, really. Inside the pillbox fighting compartment and the turret were different stories, which still lacked more modern vision devices like periscopes and bulletproof glass-laden vision slits. We'll climb inside the vehicle and detail the turret and fighting compartment shortly. One last thing about the front end of the vehicle, and specifically the driver's compartment. And this is where my obsession with machine guns comment really stems from. The driver now had two fixed front-firing 30 caliber machine guns that he could now engage with. Assuming some unassuming infantryman might run right in front of the line of fire, or maybe the driver was supposed to kind of slalom the tank back and forth to aim these machine guns, but there certainly was no elevating or depressing these machine guns. They were fixed into the nose of the vehicle. In my mind, this is one of those, in theory, seems kind of cool. It strikes fear into the enemy as you mow them down with your tank rolling forward past the trenches into their homeland, or something like that. The rear end of the hull wasn't anything too exciting. It had a flat top, a flat engine deck with some exhaust piping on the top. As we climb up the vehicle into the midship section, which includes the pillbox barbette, the sponsons, and those four rotor turret machine guns. Not to mention a turret festooned with two M2A1 37mm quick-firing cannons mounted in their T10 gun mount. However, the first delivered test model of the T5 Phase 1 was armed with a wooden dummy gun and plated with soft, mild steel in early 1937. Fun fact, this twin-mounted 37mm cannons were actually only an interim solution while the Army finished designing their new high-velocity 37mm cannon, which would be put in its place once it became available. A further fun fact, the single T5 Phase 1 prototype that still exists is at Fort Knox, Kentucky. It actually has the twin 37mm cannon still mounted. That's pretty fucking cool. This 37mm high velocity cannon wouldn't make it onto the T5 Phase 1. And by the time it was shipped to Aberdeen for proving in February of 1938, the dummy cannon was actually still mounted. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. The T5 Phase 1 operated with a 5-man crew. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you this is the first time a 5-man crew was ever used within an armored fighting vehicle, since that would simply not be true. But in regards to the U.S. medium tank program, this was a first. And it makes sense. This vehicle has a lot of shit going on. If you count the extra anti-aircraft mounted machine guns, the T5 Phase 1 was armed with 9 30 caliber machine guns and a twin 37mm cannon. That's kind of a lot of firepower. At least it's a lot of guns. So a crew of 5 makes sense. And furthermore, remember, this half barbette, half turret had the internal capacity to operate with this size crew. You know, it was a large vehicle. You know, you had driver slash forward machine gunner. You had a gunner for the main cannon, a loader, an MG gunner, a loader, an MG gunner, and a commander who was also a machine gunner. I'm sure the main gunner also got his hands dirty operating one of the machine guns on occasions as well. I mean, there was a 30 coaxially mounted, so I'm sure this thing was dumping lead at an exceedingly high rate when everyone was depressing those triggers. Above this barbette sat a fully traversable turret of an octagonal shape. The roof of the turret was almost domed in a way. From the profile view, the turret is lower in the front and the rear. It kind of forms a peak in the center of the turret, presumably to allow the commander a better vantage point, as well as keeping him out of the way of the main gunner. The turret also had vision slits on each side of the octagon, with the exception being
the rear of the turret,
which had a hatch instead that would allow ingress and egress of the turret and crew compartment. Speaking of hatches, the sponsons on either side of the turret also had hatches just above the rotor turreted machine guns, allowing for more situational awareness and another way to get in and out of the vehicle. Though in combat, it is very doubtful that these hatches would remain open. The T5 Phase 1 was still rocking and rolling with that pre-war armor of 1 inch or 25 millimeters down to about a quarter of an inch or 6 millimeters in thickness. And to be fair, this limited thickness of armor was to keep the weight of the vehicle down. Like we had mentioned before, the bridges along the American highway system were mostly only rated for 15 tons or less. The T5 Phase 1 was only just barely above the 15-ton mark, and that was when it was fully loaded. She was equipped with narrow 11 5/8 inch or 29.5 centimeters wide tracks. And these were actually rubber block tracks, which these were basically what the Sherman would be equipped with. They, of course, would be widened just a little bit. But remember, with VVSS, the maximum width the tracks could possibly be was only about 16 inches or 40.5 centimeters. These 11 5/8 inch, basically 12-inch wide tracks, with a pitch of 6 inches or 15.25 centimeters, for all intents and purposes, these are the Sherman tracks. They'll be scaled up as the weight of the vehicle increases, but what we see in this early test vehicle, both the VVSS suspension and tracks that would wind up on basically every single American armored vehicle of this class. Some minor adjustments here and there, but relatively the same. Just to point it out, this is kind of the beginning of the American armored industry's, I'm going to regret saying this, but this is the genius behind the American approach to armor during the Second World War. What do I mean by that? And please, hold all pitchforks and torches until the end. What I'm saying is, this track and suspension system, hell, even the chassis of the Sherman, I know I'm jumping ahead, but all of this equipment was made to be mass-produced. It was interchangeable, it was scalable, and it was modular, right from the get-go. I will be hearkening back to the Panther episodes throughout this series, since that is the primary adversary of the American armored industry during the 1940s. And, well, obviously, we all just spent several hours listening to me drone on about the Panther in all of those episodes. So we should have a little background on the subject at large. But really, think about it. Everything that was on the Panther, with very few exceptions, were engineered, produced, and fitted for only the Panther tank. And realistically, they were barely fitted to that tank. Especially, you know, with all that TLC and the little handmade this and the little tinkering there to get it just to fit right. Even the ammunition was basically unique for firing out of the KWK-42L70. Whereas the American philosophy was interchangeable and interoperable throughout. This also helps the U.S. Ordnance Department by simplifying their research and allowing for a lot of overlap in production, not to mention spare parts and supply logistics. If every armored vehicle uses the same bogey, the same track, the same ammunition, the same fuel, the same paint, the you know, you get the idea. It simplifies everything down the pipeline. To win a war, you have to keep your armies well supplied. Not to shit on the German thinking too much, since each nation arrived at their own triangle of armor based on their own findings. Remember, the Americans kind of knew that they were going to be fighting this next war overseas. So simplifying production and supply logistics was paramount. After all, there is an entire freaking ocean between the US and any of their enemies. Except for Canada. Sneaky ass Canada, we see you up there. Kidding. So keeping that in mind, size, weight, and supply chains were absolutely figured into the calculus of the U.S. Ordnance Department of the pre-war era and beyond. Regarding those 11 5/8 of an inch wide tracks, these provided the T5 Phase 1 with a ground pressure of 9.6 pounds per square inch, which was pretty damn good for a vehicle at the time. Remember, we want a lower ground pressure to provide a better flotation. Recalling all the way back to the 1919 ordnance program set forth by General Rockenbach, had demanded a power-to-weight ratio of 10 horsepower per ton. Well, the T5 Phase 1, equipped with the Continental air-cooled 268 horsepower engine, was rocking a 16 horsepower per ton power-to-weight ratio. And on top of that, was capable of speeds of up to 31 miles per hour, or 50 kilometers per hour. Rockenbach, who by this time had been retired for about half a decade now, he would have been proud. His 1919 mandate had insisted on only 12 miles an hour, or 19 kilometers an hour, and this medium tank prototype was nearly thrice as fast as that. I mentioned the engine was mounted to the rear, which transmitted its power through the multiple disc clutch and a long drive shaft, which connected to the constant mesh transmission and final drive, all of which was located at the very front of the vehicle. Not that I am wholly qualified to explain the ins and outs of a constant mesh transmission, but simply that a constant mesh transmission is one in which all of the gears rotate together on the main shaft, freely. The gear ratios are engaged by the clutch that connects them to the shafts, which then powers the tank. Okay. This type of transmission differs from the other, older type of a sliding mesh transmission. The benefit here of the constant mesh is that with a sliding mesh transmission, you literally have to shift the gear or slide it into position of the main shaft. The problem with this is that you have to match the speed of the gear you wish to shift into and that of the main shaft. If you mismatch these, you literally grind the gears or crash the gears together. So if you've ever heard the term a crash box transmission, or a crash gearbox, this is where that term originates. Hell, even the term shifting gears comes from these early transmissions, because you are physically and literally shifting the gear from side to side to engage the transmission. Not to say that the constant mesh transmission was going to be the end-all be-all. It was still difficult to manage properly, and a good driver was more than worth his salt in that regard. To put it into perspective, modern day manual transmissions use what is called a synchro mesh transmission, which really simplifies everything. And people still stall and grind up these gears. So manual transmissions, while they have come a long way, still require some skill. As discussed earlier, steering was of the control differential variety, along with the final drive and 12-tooth drive sprocket, which were all located in the front. Finally, the engine requires fuel, and the 125-gallon or 473-liter fuel tank. I'm sorry, I probably haven't been converting gallons to liters. A listener brought this to my attention, so thank you, Tom. Also, I'm sorry, I will try and do better. This provided the T5 Phase 1 a cruising range of 125 miles, or 201 kilometers. During the tests at the Proving Ground and Fort Benning, which took place between 1937 and about the middle of 1938, some minor modifications would be made. However, they would be mostly internal. Moving a pipe here, a wire there, the odometer looks easier to read like this. You know, minutia. There was a modification made that I absolutely fucking adore. I wonder how many of you are familiar with the Krumlauf, or curved barrel. This was a rather short-lived and not really all that successful barrel attachment for the German Sturmgewehr 44, or STG 44, or even further, the MP 44. The original assault rifle, as some might say. You've seen it, I've seen it, great. Why am I bringing it up? Well, just like this curved barrel, which was envisioned as some kind of revolution to close quarters combat and even anti-infantry vehicle support, the Krumlauf allowed its user to fire effectively around corners, blind corners. This was achieved by the addition of a curved or angled barrel. There were a few different versions, 30 degrees, 45, 60, and even a 90 degree Krumlauf. Though only the 30 degree variant would ever see much production, and even then, the thing didn't really operate like they had wanted. The bullets would fragment and shear, causing more of a shotgun type projectile than a bullet. Though some success was realized after modifications were made, about 100 meters, this thing could be effective, which is not bad if you're just shooting around a corner. There was also an additional, you know, they had like a mirrored style optics to see around the corner. It was all a bit of a weird try and kind of a mess. I'm only bringing this up because the idea of deflecting bullets into blind spots was not just a Nazi endeavor. Several countries, in fact, tried their hands at similar tactics. The U.S. Ordnance Department was not to be excluded in this party. The T-5 Phase 1 had installed to the rear two steel plates, which were angled in such a way that the two rear-facing rotor-turreted 30 caliber machine guns could aim at. And once these plates were struck with 30 caliber bullets, those bullets would then deflect down behind the tank. Holy shit, right? But wait, there's more. These angled plates were there not only to keep infantry off the rear of the vehicle, but it was also envisioned that while the tank was traversing an enemy trench line in foxholes, the rear machine guns would just be just holding down the trigger and shooting down, it bouncing off these plates, and they would shoot down on top of the hapless infantry, hugging the ground in their hidey hole positions. This just screams like steampunk or Warhammer logic. It's fucking crazy, but I love it. It was installed in 1938 and would literally remain on the vehicle throughout its lifespan. I don't know. I'll post a picture. It's insane. I love it. The test results were actually quite favorable for the T5 Phase 1 as a whole, and the chief of infantry recommended the vehicle be standardized and put into full service with the U.S. Army. The recommendation came for the T5 Phase 1 outfitted with the new high-velocity 37mm cannon. Quote, "The Ordnance Committee concurred in standardization of the T5 Phase 1 as the medium tank M2 was recommended by OCM 14529 on June 2nd of 1938 and was later approved by OCM 14576 that very same month of June in 1938. End quote. With the Phase 1 version of the T-5 accepted as the medium tank M2? That was it. We're done with it. No, I'm kidding. The Ordnance Department actually decided to continue prototyping testing on several phases of the T-5 prototype. Just a little caveat here. The T-5 Phase 2 was actually never built. And according to Honeycutt, quote, no medium tank T5 Phase 2 was ever actually built, as the designation was reserved only for a design study, end quote. So, moving right along, the T5 Phase 3 was a further development in the M2/T5 project. Mainly, the Phase 3 was to see how much improvement could be made to both performance and armor, whilst keeping the vehicle neatly under the now new 20-ton limit. The primary visible difference between the Phase 1 and the Phase 3 would be the shift of driver's position. Instead of keeping him middle of the front, they decided to put him back on the floor of the vehicle and shifted him over to the left again. Additionally, the VVSS suspension return rollers were moved from offside, they were kind of just displaced a little bit, to now being directly above and centerline of each of the pairs of bogies. Looking at this vehicle head-on gives me the creeps. But that's just because the angles are all wrong, unnatural, and very Lovecraftian in nature. Finally, the high-velocity 37mm T3 cannon was made available, which was seated in the T1 mount. Yes, folks, the T5 Phase 3 was armed with a T3 and a T1 on the T5. Got it? Good. Armor protection on the Phase 3 was also being increased, especially on the turret, which was now boasting 1 7/16 inch, or 36.5 millimeters in actual numbers. While the hull was also increased, at least the front-facing portions of the vehicle, to a staggering 1 1/4 inch, or about 32 millimeters thick. And depending on which variant we'd like to compare this to, the Panzer III, which I would consider a contemporary of the T5 Phase 3 project, at least kind of, the Alps A through C had only about 15 millimeters of armor, while the later Alps D through G boasted 30 millimeters in thickness, a little more than an inch. And of course, the last variant of the Panzer III, the Aufsprung J, was something like 50 millimeters, nearly 2 inches thick. So obviously, this 1938 medium prototype wasn't competing with the later era of the Aufsprung J, but in a sense, this armor setup in 1938 for the T5 wasn't that bad, at least, you know, compared to the contemporaries. Power plant improvements were also forthcoming in the fall of 1938 for the T5 Phase 3. The now new 9-cylinder Wright air-cooled radial engine, known as the R975 Whirlwind, which would later famously power the M18 Hellcat tank destroyer, which was one of the fastest armored fighting vehicles until about the 1970s, once the M1 Abrams came about. This may surprise some of you, but this engine was originally developed to power airplanes. Though in this application, this engine was known as the R975EC2. It was a license-built copy which Continental made work within the confines of an armored vehicle. Neat, right? Sort of. Well, the Americans did not dedicate any particular sector to designing strictly armored engines. The applications of aeronautic radial engines in armored fighting vehicles proved satisfactory. Though a noticeable drawback was the engine height, which then demanded that the vehicles in which they were placed in had to be taller to accommodate the space required for the power plant. Remember I was talking about how the vehicle had to be taller for the drive shaft? Now we're looking at the vehicle is going to need to be taller still because of the engine. More on that later. With this new configuration, the T5 Phase 3 now weighed in at 21 tons. Power to weight ratio was still good at 14 horsepower per ton, a maximum speed of 32.9 miles per hour, or 53 kilometers an hour, a fuel capacity was increased to now 132 gallons. However, the added weight restricted the cruising range to a mere 103 miles or 165 kilometers. And I'm sorry, Tom, I did it again. 132 gallons is about 500 liters capacity. Because of this added weight, the tracks were very quickly widened to the maximum allowance of 16 inches or 40 and a half centimeters. This limit was due to the restriction, which was self-imposed by the VVSS system. The bogies could only be so wide to accommodate the volute springs. This would be solved later, but for now, them's the brakes. Even so, increasing the track width to 16 inches, the ground pressure actually increased to 12.2 psi. This is not great. However, despite this shortcoming, the T5 Phase 3 was lauded for its speed and handling. The differential steering was further improved to handle the speed of this vehicle, and for the folks who got their hands on it, we're all in agreement that the T5 Phase 3 was all right. A small quick aside, a one-off variant of the T5 Phase 3, which was known as the T5E1, in September of 1938. This vehicle was a test bed for the, and I'm going to butcher this name, Giberson air-cooled radial diesel engine, which was a small division of the Giberson Corporation that manufactured oil industry equipment. The engine was not horrible, and being a diesel engine had the extra bonus of not catching on fire as easily as a gasoline engine. But at the time, that wasn't really on the developers' minds. They were simply trying out new engines as they became available to find that unicorn engine that was both lightweight, powerful. The idea of finding the perfect engine is always something that the American armored industry was looking for. So the Giberson T1020 diesel would find success, but not with the T5 program. Instead, it would later find success in the M3 and the M3A1 light tank, of which about 1,500 or so would be equipped with the Giberson diesel. Fun, right? Well, we'll have to revisit the M3 series of light tanks at another time, on another series. But for now, Giberson is just a footnote in our Sherman story, as we won't be seeing them anytime soon. Finally, well, sort of finally, the Army wished to try out a larger caliber weapon upon the T5 Phase 3 chassis, which was willing and able to house the 75mm howitzer M1A1. Since the barbette of the T5 Phase 3 was already there, a simple elimination of the right-hand rotor-turreted machine gun and the introduction of the M3A1 howitzer cradle, or carriage, was installed without any problem. Removing the T3 37mm and the larger turret, a smaller and quite odd-looking turret was instead installed. I have to say, this is one of the oddest-looking turrets I've ever seen. It looks like a sniper blind from the Great War, combined with the bolts on the side of Frankenstein's monster's neck. Also, it had a 30 caliber machine gun. Also, it had like a rangefinder in it. The turret itself was rather tall. It was hexagonal in shape. It looked like a nut. With a step down in front where the machine gun protrudes. And this turret was tall because those Frankenstein monster bolts were where the rangefinder was housed, which then allowed for sighting and ranging of the howitzer. This also gave the commander of the vehicle a pretty good observation post that would be, you know, slightly armored, but still, you know, real tall and above the vehicle. This new version of the T5 Phase 3 was redesignated medium tank T5E2. During all of the testing at Aberdeen between April of 39 all the way through to February of 1940, and yes, that 1940, the war is going on, the T5E2 by all accounts, was successful. The howitzer was effective at both area and pointed attacks. Direct and indirect fire allowed this thing to menace any position and, at the time, would wreck any piece of armor on the field. The Army and the Ordnance Department were quite impressed, noting that this was, you know, this kind of application of installing a howitzer onto armored vehicles was not only feasible, but quite effective. With Europe already in flames, again, the U.S. would be keeping this T5E2 mobile howitzer in mind. And if you're curious where they took this project, one only needs to look up the M7 Priest, which kind of basically looks like the grown-up version of the T5E2. Well, that is going to do it for the T5 Phase 1, 2, 3, the T5E1, and finally the T5E2. Covering 5 vehicles in one episode is quite a bit of a feat. And don't at me, I know the Phase 2 never really existed, but I'm inflating my numbers. The point is, even though the Phase 1 was standardized as the medium tank M2, the research and development was far from finished. We'll have ourselves an opportunity to pore over the M2 in greater detail next episode as we inch ever closer to the early war Sherman tanks and their initial combat foray in North Africa. I hope you all have been enjoying the pacing and the length of these episodes. I was having a conversation with a dear friend of mine, whose opinion I value greatly, and as far as the one person I have surveyed, he said, so far so good. Thanks, David. I really do appreciate any and all feedback. You guys, the listeners, the fine folk who, you know, tune in every 2 weeks to the Panzer podcast, are just as important to me as the material that I am disseminating. So thanks again. You people are fucking fantastic. I don't think I'm ever going to run ads, like actual ads. I mean, maybe, but I don't think so. I'm not a fan of them, and I get it for podcasts that are out there really doing like actual work and making a living. But for me, I'm a small indie podcaster with it's such a niche topic. And with that said, I'm going to spam you guys just a little bit here and self-promote myself. If you are interested in supporting the show, you can navigate yourself to thepanzerpodcast.bigcartel.com. Using code PRESALEPANZER2022, one word, PRESALEPANZER2022, and you will receive 20% off your sticker. I would say you would get 20% off your order, but as I only have the one product, which is the sticker, up for sale at the moment, that's what we're going with. It is, of course, it's the Panther. You know, it's a blacked out silhouette of a panther with the name of the podcast, the Panzer Podcast, inside of it. I think it's pretty cool. We're working on making a Sherman sticker, and I'm going to do as many tanks as possible. So for every tank we cover, I'm going to try and get a sticker up for that tank because I think that's kind of cool. I'm also tossing the idea around about maybe some shirts or something, but I move about as fast as a tortoise on parade. Anyway, that's the ad break for the Panzer Podcast. I know it sounds like I'm ad-libbing, but I really wrote it this way. Once again, that's thepanzerpodcast.bigcartel.com. As always, I can be reached via email at thepanzerpodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at thepanzerpod, and on Instagram at thepanzerpodcast. If you like what we're doing here, I would appreciate a positive review on Apple Podcast or Spotify or however you're listening, if possible, because it does help us reach new audience members, and I super appreciate it. And speaking of appreciating it, thank you guys for understanding that my voice was trash last weekend and being patient with me. All right, folks, until next time, I'm John Burgess. Thanks for listening.